Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
From public health crises to geopolitical stressors, the last few years have been marked by immense change. How is this influencing our shopping habits and how should businesses adapt? Find out in Adyen's Behind the Figures Season 2, the podcast that goes beyond the data to explore the trends shaping different sectors. Join me, Charmaine Yi, as I chat with leading Asia-Pacific brands on how sustainable business practices can create new growth opportunities. Listen to Behind the Figures wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here, and I'm excited to tell you that my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a second season, and it's available now. Find out more at the end of this podcast.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 6th of March, these are our main stories. Police and protesters clash in Greece as many blame cost-cutting for Tuesday's deadly train crash. China has announced it will increase military spending by more than 7%. A fire in a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh leaves thousands homeless. Also in this podcast...
Ladies and gentlemen, the ship has reached the shore.
15 years of negotiations for a high seas treaty have finally borne fruit. We begin this podcast in Greece. Where there has been another day of protests over last week's deadly train crash, despite an apology and an appeal for forgiveness from the Prime Minister. The head-on collision of two trains, which left 57 people dead, has sparked fury over lax safety standards on the Greek railway network, with many blaming privatisation and cost-cutting. Joining striking rail workers and protesters, the leader of the Railway Drivers' Union, Kostas Genigdounias, said warnings had been ignored.
Despite the continuous warnings of the workers, there was criminal indifference by those responsible to our requests over the safety systems, and that's what led to this tragic accident. No one is feeling good at the moment. It's a tragic situation for the whole of society, not just for the workers.
We got more from Anthi Karasava, a journalist in Athens.
Since the tragic train crash, rolling protests have gripped Greece, with demonstrators, largely youth and railway employees, venting their anger and frustration at the state for what they say is a repeated show of negligence concerning major infrastructure projects. And that is what this frustration is really all about.
Because the big fear for many people is that someone will be scapegoated. We saw the station master appear in court.
Absolutely. He did appear before court, before a prosecutor probing the causes of this accident. He has accepted blame for a horrific mistake of not switching lines and keeping both these trains, one passenger train and another freight train, on the same line, knowing that he took to this air and waiting 17 minutes without doing anything. But at the same time, his lawyer has said that there's accountability to be found elsewhere, whether it's within the railway network and the system itself, and also higher up. And that is what Greeks want to see right now, especially as accountability to be found, and for justice to prevail, and for these problems to be fixed. I mean, beyond the human tragedy of what we saw, this tragic, horrific accident, this crash has sent shockwaves across the nation, when many of people have just realized that their sole railway network has effectively been operating for decades blind without effective security measures in place.
Anthi Karasava. Much applause, nodding delegates and praise for the government. Those are the usual ingredients for the annual meeting of China's rubber stamp parliament or National People's Congress. Among the announcements made in Beijing were a somewhat reduced growth target, but at the same time substantially increased military spending. Stephen McDonnell reports from Beijing.
Inside the cavernous Great Hall of the People, nearly 3,000 delegates gathered for the annual National People's Congress. It was the first such meeting since the dramatic abandonment of zero COVID, following widespread protests against citywide lockdowns and the restrictions on people's movements which were killing the economy. Outgoing Premier Li Keqiang defended the party's handling of the pandemic.
We overcame difficulties. We succeeded in maintaining an overall stable economic performance. In a complex, fluid environment, we were generally able to hit our main targets.
That this year's growth target has been set at a relatively modest 5% shows there are still major challenges with real estate debt, global pressure on China's tech companies, and youth unemployment. Some analysts have warned that the new party leadership could itself be part of the problem. At this Congress, Xi Jinping is expected to replace any ministers and department heads not directly aligned to him with clear loyalists, many who worked with the president as he came through the ranks in the provinces. The danger, though, is that he'll be stuck in an echo chamber, surrounded by people not prepared to offer the frank and fearless advice a world leader needs to hear.
Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. So how is the West likely to react to this big increase in Chinese military spending? Jonathan Marcus is a defence analyst.
Well, it's not just the West. I think it's China's neighbours in the region as well. China's spending, after all, is more than the next 13 countries in the Indo-Pacific area combined. So it's a great worry to them, too. I think for the West, particularly the United States and Australia, it will confirm their view that China is significantly rearming, not just in the quantity of its weaponry, but in the quality of its weaponry as well. And of course, that is a huge worry in terms of what many see as a potential military ambition of China to take Taiwan, to seize Taiwan by force.
And there are also concerns that China might be looking at providing military aid to Russia in Ukraine.
There are indeed. We know that China and Russia are very close, despite some of the things it's been saying. China has essentially backed Russia in its Ukraine operations. China has been very cautious, though, so far in supplying any weaponry or ammunition to Russia. Russia, of course, is very short of ammunition. It's used up large quantities of its most modern weaponry in the campaign so far. I think the real problem for China, and the Chinese seem to imply that they won't be supplying weaponry, that's to be seen. I think the real thing with relations between Beijing and Washington at such a low ebb, I'm not sure the Chinese are very worried about what the Americans think, but I think they are still concerned about how they go down in European capitals. And I think if China were to start supplying weaponry to Russia, first of all, it would change the dynamics of the conflict significantly, but it would also jeopardize Chinese relations with many of the key European economic actors.
Jonathan Marcus. A massive fire has devastated one of the crowded refugee camps for Rohingya Muslims in southern Bangladesh, leaving thousands of people homeless. Farah Kabir works for ActionAid in the country.
We host more than a million people in the Rohingya refugee camps. And so far, over 12,000 people have been affected. It's dry season and the wind was blowing, so it quickly spread. I mean, in such a short time, in just 2 hours, it had damaged a huge area.
Our South Asia regional editor, Ambrasan Etirajan, told us more.
The pictures from the camp, they show that how terrified refugees, men, women and children, are running away from this area, taking their meager belongings. And they were crying. There was a lot of tension in the camp because people were very scared that the fire could spread to the rest of the camp. This is where hundreds of thousands of people live. You know, this is the one of the largest refugee settlements in the world, where nearly a million Rohingya refugees live in camps scattered in the Cox's Bazar district. But the fire was brought under control within 3 hours. There were a number of teams that were working on that. But officials say that so far there have been no casualties and also did not spread to other areas of the camp. So that is another big relief for the authorities. They managed to bring it under control. It shows the conditions of these camps. You know, people have been coming from Myanmar because of violence against them, you know, for the last 15 years, and especially in 2017, there was a major Myanmar military crackdown. It is a clear reminder of how the squalid conditions of the camp, you know, you see the number of fires happening in these areas.
But nevertheless, thousands of people are now homeless. Do we have any idea what caused this fire?
So far, officials have not given any indication what started the fire. But in the past, there have been a number of incidents. It is because of, you know, people cooking with stoves, even though people have been provided dry rations. Sometimes fires start from accidents. Some of the Rohingya community leaders say it also sabotages or arson attacks that started a fire. There is infighting going on between various groups within the camps. And also the Bangladeshi government, you know, that is why they argue that they should be removed or taken from these crowded camps because of the safety fears and taken to an island, Bashan Chaur Island, where they can be given more space. Here, people are having these, you know, bamboo-built small huts. They're using polythene papers, tin roofs. So it's not really fire-safe and also very crowded. The density is very high. That's one of the reasons why the Bangladeshi government argues that it is safer for them to be moved to this island. But many Rohingya refugees would want to stay within the camps because they live within their relatives, friends. They don't want to be remaining in an isolated place, an island where, you know, they have to travel by boat by several hours to come to the mainland to see their relatives. But the situation of the refugees is again a reminder to the world community. You know, nearly a million people are living here in squalid conditions. And it also, you know, they cannot be provided, you know, very fire-safe buildings or fire-safe houses. A reminder about this community to the rest of the world.
I'm Brasan Etirajan. In the last podcast, we reported on how negotiations to agree a long-awaited UN treaty to protect the world's high seas had dragged on beyond the deadline. But now, after days of grueling around-the-clock talks at the UN's headquarters in New York, a deal has finally been struck by, I imagine, some rather bleary-eyed negotiators.
Ladies and gentlemen, the ship has reached the shore.
That was Rena Lee, the conference president, announcing that after years of negotiations, the countries of the UN have agreed to establish millions of square kilometres of marine protected areas. Our climate and science reporter, Esme Stallard, has been speaking to my colleague, Nick Miles.
It's historic in the fact that countries have come together and got an agreement. And this has come at a time when there's a lot of tense geopolitics in the world. So it has been heralded as a real success that they have managed to get in a room and actually reach an agreement.
OK, so now does come the tricky part, trying to make sure that these protected marine reserves, what, millions of square kilometres of them in very inaccessible areas, are protected. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, exactly. You'd almost say the hard bit is yet to come still. At the moment, they're going to set up a technical committee which will look at the different ways that they can go about protecting these areas. It might be that they use existing mechanisms like fisheries associations, but also a big question at these treaties was raising enough money to do this. And developing or poorer nations were asking for more money from their richer counterparts to make sure they could partake and help to protect the high seas.
And what about the number of species that are at risk of extinction or endangered in these areas? Can you put figures on those?
So the IUCN, which is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, they make this red list of extinction species. They estimate about 10% of the species they've assessed are at risk of extinction. But there are many, many more species we don't know about. We estimate almost 2 million species are out there in the deep seas, and we only know about a few hundred thousand of them.
And any one of those species, if they go extinct, there could be keystone species that have a knock-on effect on others as well.
Exactly. There's a whole chain in these high seas that is going to be massively affected, from phytoplankton all the way up to very big animals. And also what scientists are concerned about is that there's very unique genetic material in the deep seas which can be very useful for societies. There's already been major drug breakthroughs from the material that we've got from the deep seas, including some of the first early HIV medicines and also for cancer treatment.
Esme Stallard. Still to come on this podcast.
This is not a legal form of entry to Canada. If you decide to cross, you're going to get arrested.
The remote rural road in Canada being used as a migration route loophole. Pictures show rain slashing sideways, roofs blown off houses and trees flung across roads after a powerful earthquake and two cyclones hit the South Pacific nation of Vanuatu this week. The storms have cut power supplies to tens of thousands of people and officials have declared a state of emergency. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, is shipping emergency supplies in from Fiji. Eric Dupere is head of the organisation in Vanuatu.
According to the government, we work on the assumption that 200,000 people have been affected, which may be about two-thirds of the country population. Vanuatu has 83 islands, but 90% of the population live in about 20 islands. And that's very difficult to reach. We used to fly from island to island using small plane. The two cyclones have put the small planes upside down. So I don't know when they will be able to fly again. But if we look at the main affected provinces, which are Shefa, the central province, and Tafea, the southern province. Here, from a UNICEF perspective, we are focusing a lot on children. So, for instance, in these two affected provinces, you have 4,500 children under 1 year. So these children need to go to health center for immunization, for many things. We have almost 23,000 children under 5 years. We have almost 5,000 pregnant mothers. Safe delivery, antenatal care, and so on is a real challenge. If we look at the education side, children are very highly affected because we don't know yet the scale of the damage, but we can assume that a lot of the schools have been damaged or completely destroyed. Gardens have been also completely destroyed. So food security and nutrition is a real issue. Water network have been damaged and water will be contaminated. But I'm sure the people have the moral resource to face this situation. They are starting again to work. They are strong people. What we like is financial resources to scale up our response.
Eric Dupere from UNICEF. Canada is dealing with an influx of migrants crossing illegally from the United States. Last year, more than 39,000 people entered Canada, mostly by a remote rural road linking New York State to Quebec. But many face a long road to freedom and stability in Canada. Nadine Youssef reports.
Hey, stop right there. Speak English?
Yeah. Oh,
hey, this is not a legal form of entry to Canada. If you decide to cross, you're going to get arrested.
This is a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer speaking to migrants who are about to cross into Quebec from the United States at Roxham Road. The rural paved road is an unofficial crossing into Canada. It is a popular loophole fueled by the Safe Third Country Agreement between Canada and the United States, which forces migrants to seek asylum in the first country they step foot in. Those trying to cross from the U.S. into Canada at official crossings would be turned away. At Roxham Road, however, they can enter, sometimes without a passport or visa, be arrested, and then apply for refugee status once on Canadian soil.
Just right now in the corridor, there's about 15 Latino families that just showed up because they heard about us.
Maurice Poisson works at Welcome Collective, a center that helps newcomers in Montreal with anything from giving out toys and winter clothes to providing legal support.
One of the new reality that we see these days is we have so many families dropping in.
The reality on the ground in Canada for many migrants has been challenging. The backlog in refugee claims has increased 26% last year, and some are being forced to wait nearly 2 years to receive crucial documents that can allow them to work or access social benefits. Poisson believes it is the responsibility of both the Canadian and Quebec governments to do more for these migrants.
As a society, we're just winning if refugee claimants can get their work permit and work, you know, like really it makes a big difference to just process these first steps quickly so they can be active in society.
Quebec's premier, François Legault, has asked Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to close Roxham Road, saying his province can no longer accept migrants with dignity. The opposition has also placed pressure on Mr. Trudeau to do the same.
This is a real prime minister. He is responsible for those borders. That is why conservatives are calling for the prime minister to implement a plan to close the Roxham Road crossing within 30 days from now.
In response, Mr. Trudeau said he is speaking with his American counterparts to renegotiate the Safe Third Country Agreement. For now, there's no telling what the future of Roxham Road will be, but people continue to make the long journey to Canada with hopes of finding a better life.
Why Canada? Why Quebec? Because your people. I feel me protect. Montreal is my new home, the only home I have.
Nadine Youssef. She helped pave the way for the Americans with Disabilities Act and served in both the Clinton and Obama administrations. Now, Judy Heumann, one of the leading disability campaigners in the US, has died at the age of 75. She was among those who organized the longest protest occupation of a US federal building. For more than 3 weeks in 1977, the protesters didn't move from the Health, Education and Welfare Building in San Francisco.
The outrage of disabled individuals across country is going to continue. It is going to be ignited. There will be more takeovers of buildings until finally maybe you begin to understand our position. We will no longer allow the government to oppress disabled individuals. We want the law enforced. We want no more segregation. We will accept no more discussion of segregation.
Anna Landre is a disability justice activist and wheelchair user who was mentored by Ms. Heumann. She spoke to my colleague Julian Marshall, who started by asking her what memory of Ms. Heumann she would most like to hold on to.
Oh, God, there are so many. When I worked for her out of her apartment, there was a gym down the road and across the street from her apartment building. And this gym was in a building that used to be wheelchair accessible. And then the gym moved in and they renovated it and they added a step onto the front door. And Judy passed this place almost every day and it enraged her that she'd fought for the Americans with Disabilities Act. And here was this building, like so many others, that was just in clear violation of it. Once a week, she would take me and we would go down to the gym and she would knock on the window because we couldn't get to the door. And she would ask them, why didn't they have a ramp? She would say, I want to go to the gym. Maybe I want to go exercise. We would go and fight these people. And I think it's just a really good example of how Judy never stopped fighting.
I think she once said words to the effect of that it's not disability that impedes a disabled person, but their exclusion. You go along with that.
Absolutely. I think the social model of disability is something that was really formative for Judy and her peers in the 60s, 70s, 80s. You know, she was denied access to her school because they said she was a fire hazard. Then she was denied the ability to be a teacher because they said she couldn't properly teach and get her students out in the event of an emergency. Decades and decades later, and in primary school, was told I couldn't sit with my friends at the lunch table because my wheelchair was a fire hazard. And so you have to think about it and think, was my disability really the problem there? Or is it the way that we choose to treat disabled people, the way we see disability in the greater structure of the world? And I think the answer is pretty clear.
That was Anna Landre speaking about disability campaigner Judy Heumann, who has died at the age of 75. The curtains have closed on Africa's biggest film festival, FESPACO. Thousands of filmmakers flocked to Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, from across the continent to take part in the week-long event. But as Daniel Dadzi reports, it took place against the backdrop of violence in Burkina Faso.
It was a night of glitz and glamour.
The bright lights and vibrant performances crowned a week dedicated to celebrating the best of cinema from the continent. But throughout the festival, the presence of heavily armed soldiers and fearsome tanks gave a haunting reminder of an uncomfortable reality. It's a reality that Burkinabe filmmaker Apolline Traoré knows too well.
I live in a country that's been fighting terrorism for a very long time. I only have my art to express myself, and this was a way for me to participate in this fight against terrorism by expressing myself through my art.
Burkina Faso has seen a surge in jihadist attacks since 2015. This has displaced 2 million people. The terrorism was the direct cause of two coups d'etat in the West African country in 2022. The festival had been scheduled to take place last year, but because of the instability, it was postponed until now. Here is Delegate General Alex Moussa Sawadogo.
It's true that Burkina Faso has been facing an immense difficulties in recent years. However, by organizing an event like FESPACO, the authorities here are sending a clear message to the world, saying Burkina Faso is back on its feet.
The festival itself had 170 films shortlisted from 1,300 entries. The top prize was won by Tunisian movie Ashkal, directed by Youssef Chebbi. Apolline's film, Sira, won second prize. Set in the deserts of the Sahel, Sira tells the story of a family ripped apart by Islamist violence. Like the festival itself, her victory is seen as a testament to the people of Burkina Faso who refuse to be intimidated by violence.
Daniel Dadsey. And from one red carpet to another, Hollywood stars have been letting their hair down at the Independent Spirit Awards in Santa Monica, California. They are the top honours in America for independent movies that cost less than $30 million to make. Wendy Urquhart reports.
It's an event on the awards calendar that everyone looks forward to. The actors are jovial, the mood is light, and nobody has to be on their best behaviour. The red carpet was awash with stars, including Jamie Lee Curtis, Michelle Yeoh, Cate Blanchett and Paul Mescal. Everything Everywhere All at Once took top honours on the night, scooping 7 of the top prizes at the Independent Spirit Awards, including Best Feature Film, Best Director, Best Supporting Performance and Best Lead Performance for Michelle Yeoh. The movie is about a Chinese-American laundromat owner who's struggling to finish her taxes when she's swept into an alternate universe, and the film is already at the centre of the Oscar buzz in Los Angeles. Elsewhere, Joyland was named Best International Film and All the Beauty and the Bloodshed won Best Documentary. Now Los Angeles is gearing up for the biggest bash of the year. But who will take home the coveted Oscars will be kept firmly under wraps until March 12th.
Wendy Urquhart. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Madeline Drury. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
What do you want your daughter to know?
I want her to know from the time she's very young that she is her own person.
What does she need to know?
Despite our challenging life journey, do you know you were born into so much love?
Dear Daughter is a podcast creating a handbook for life, full of advice for daughters everywhere. And we're back for season 2. More touching personal stories.
Dear Daughter, I don't know what it feels like to grow up being as supported as you are.
More letters of advice.
all I can do as their parent is offer whatever wisdom I can.
And some very special guests, like best-selling author Isabel Allende.
My mother would tell me things that usually mothers don't share with their daughters about money, about sex, about her past, about her dreams.
That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
From public health crises to geopolitical stressors, the last few years have been marked by immense change. How is this influencing our shopping habits and how should businesses adapt? Find out in Adyen's Behind the Figures Season 2, the podcast that goes beyond the data to explore the trends shaping different sectors. Join me, Charmaine Yi, as I chat with leading Asia-Pacific brands on how sustainable business practices can create new growth opportunities. Listen to Behind the Figures wherever you get your podcasts.